Chapter 9. Bishop Timothy Archer conceived in his mind, after much prayer and pondering, after much application of his brilliant analytical faculties, the notion that he had no choice but to step down as bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of California and go, as he phrased it, into the private sector. He discussed this matter with Kirsten and me at length. "I have no faith in the reality of Christ," he informed us. "None whatsoever. I cannot in good conscience go on preaching the kerygma of the New Testament. And every time I get up in front of my congregation, I feel that I am deceiving them." "You told Bill Lundborg that night that Christ's reality is proven by Jeff coming back," I said. "It's not," Tim said. "It fails to. I have exhaustively scrutinized the situation, and it fails to." "What does it prove, then?" Kirsten said. "Life after death," Tim said, "but not the reality of Christ. Jesus was a teacher whose teachings were not even original. I have the name of a medium, a Dr. Garrett, living in Santa Barbara. I will be flying down there to consult him, to try to talk to Jeff. Mr. Mason recommends him." He examined a slip of paper. "Oh," he said, "Dr. Garrett is a woman. Rachel Garrett. I was certain it was a man." He asked if the two of us wished to accompany him to Santa Barbara. It was his intention, he explained, to ask Jeff about Christ. Jeff could tell him through the medium, Dr. Rachel Garrett, if Christ were real or not, genuinely the Son of God, and all the rest of the stuff that the churches teach. This would be an important trip. Tim's decision as to whether to resign his post as bishop hinged on this. Moreover, Tim's faith was involved. He had spent decades rising within the Episcopal Church, but now he seriously doubted whether Christianity was valid. That was Tim's term, valid. It struck me as a weak and trendy term, falling tragically short of the magnitude of the forces contending within Tim's heart and mind. However, it was the term he used. He spoke in a calm manner, devoid of any hysterical overtones. It was as if he were planning whether or not to buy a suit of clothes. "Christ," he said, "is a role, not a person. It, the word, is a mistransliteration from the Hebrew, Messiah, which literally means the anointed one, which is to say, the chosen one. The Messiah, of course, comes at the end of the world and ushers in the age of gold, which replaces the age of iron, the age we now live in." This finds its most beautiful expression in the fourth eclogue of Virgil. Let me see, I have it here. He went to his books, as he always did in time of gravity. "We don't need to hear Virgil," Kirsten said in a biting tone. "Here it is," Tim said, oblivious to her. "Ultima cumai, venit eum carminis, itas magnus." "That's enough," Kirsten said sharply. He glanced at her, puzzled. Kirsten said, "I think it's insanely foolish and selfish of you to resign as bishop." "Let me translate the eclogue for you at least," Tim said. "Then you'll understand better." "I understand that you're destroying your life and mine," Kirsten said. "What about me?" He shook his head. "I'll be hired on at the Foundation for Free Institutions." "What the hell is that?" Kirsten said. "It's a think tank," I said, "in Santa Barbara." "Then you're going to be talking with them while you're down there?" Kirsten said. "Yes," he nodded. "I have an appointment with Pomeroy, who's in charge of it, Felton Pomeroy. I'd be their consultant in theological matters." "They're very highly thought of," I said. Kirsten gave me a look that would have withered trees. "There's been nothing decided," Tim said. "We are going to see Rachel Garrett anyhow. I see no reason why I shouldn't combine the two in a single trip. That way I'll have to fly down there only once." "I'm supposed to set up your appointments," Kirsten said. "Actually," Tim said, "this will be a purely informal discussion. We'll have lunch, I'll meet the other consultants. I'll see their buildings and gardens. They have very lovely gardens. I saw the Foundation's gardens several years ago and still remember them. To me," he said, "you'll love them. Angel, every kind of rose is represented, especially peace. All the 5-star patented roses are there, or however it is roses are rated. May I read the two of you the translation of Virgil's eclogue?" Now comes the final age denounced in the Cumaean Sibyl's chant. The great succession of epics is born anew. Now the Virgin returns, the reign of Saturn returns. Now a new race descends from heaven on high. O chaste Lucina, goddess of births, smile upon the boy just born, in whose time the race of iron shall first cease, and a race of gold shall arise throughout the world. Thine own Apollo is now king. Kirsten and I looked at each other. I saw Kirsten's lips move, but I heard no sound. Heaven only knows what she was saying and thinking at that moment, as she witnessed Tim shoot down his career and life out of conviction. More properly, lack of conviction, faith in the Savior. The problem for Kirsten was simply that she could not see the problem. To her, Tim's dilemma was a phantom dilemma, manufactured for bookish reasons. According to her reasoning, he had the option to shed the problem any time he saw fit. Her analysis was simply that Tim had become restive in his job as bishop and wanted to move on. Asserting a loss of faith in Christ was his way of justifying his career move. Since it was a stupid career move, she did not approve. After all, she gained so very much from his status, as she had said. Tim was not thinking about her. He thought only of himself. Dr. Garrett is highly recommended, Tim said, almost in a plaintive voice, as if appealing to one or the other of us for support. Tim, I said, I really think...
You think with your crotch, Kirsten said.
What? I said.
You heard me. I know about your little conversations that you two have after I go to bed, when you're alone. And I know you've been meeting.
Meeting what? I said.
Each other.
Christ, I said.
Christ, Kirsten echoed. Always Christ. Always the summoning of the Almighty Son of God to justify your selfishness and what you're up to. I find it disgusting. I find both of you disgusting.
To Tim, she said, I know you visited her goddamn record store last week.
To buy an album, Tim said, a Fidelio.
You could have gotten it here in the city, Kirsten said, or I could have picked it up for you.
Tim said, I wanted to see what she had.
She doesn't have anything I don't have. Kirsten said.
The Missa Solemnis, Tim said faintly. He seemed dazed, appealing to me. He said, can you reason with her?
I can reason with myself, Kirsten said. I can reason out exactly what's going on.
You better knock off taking those downers, Kirsten, I said.
And you better stop turning on 5 times a day.
Her look carried such furious hate that I could not credit my senses.
You smoke enough grass to... She broke off. More than the San Francisco Police Department uses in a month.
I'm sorry. I'm not feeling well. Excuse me.
She walked into the bedroom, the door shut silently after her. We could hear her stirring around. Then we heard her go to the bathroom. Water ran. She was taking a pill, probably a barbiturate. To Tim, who stood inert and amazed, I said,
barbiturates cause that kind of personality change. It's the pills talking, not her.
I think he rallied. I really want to fly down to Santa Barbara and see Dr. Garrett. Do you think it's the fact that she's a woman?
Kirsten, I said.
Or Garrett.
Garrett. I could swear it was a man.
I just now noticed the first name. I may have gotten it wrong. Maybe that's what's upsetting her. She'll calm down. We'll go together. Dr. Mason said that Dr. Garrett is elderly and infirm and semi-retired, so she won't pose any threat to Kirsten once she sees her.
To change the subject, I said, did you play the Missa Solemnis that I sold you?
No, Tim said vaguely. I haven't had time.
It's not the best recording, I said.
Columbia uses a peculiar microphone placement. They have microphones scattered around throughout the orchestra with the idea of bringing out the individual instruments. The idea is good, but it does away with hall ambiance.
It bothers her that I'm stepping down, Tim said, as bishop.
You should think about it longer, I said, before you do it. Are you sure it's this medium that you want to consult? Isn't there someone in the church you go to when you have a spiritual crisis?
I will be consulting Jeff. The medium acts as a passive agent, much in the fashion that a telephone acts.
He went on then to explain how misunderstood mediums are. I half listened, neither impressed nor caring. Kirsten's hostility had upset me, even though I had become used to it.
This amounted to more than her chronic bitchiness. "I can tell a red freak when I see one," I said to myself. "The personality change, the hair trigger response, the paranoia. She is crapping out on us," I said to myself. "She is going down the drain. Worse, she is not going down the drain alone. Her nails are dug deep in us, and we go perforce along. Shit, this is just dreadful. A man like Tim Archer should not have to put up with this. I should not have to." Kirsten opened the bedroom door. "Come in here," she said to Tim. "I will in a minute," Tim said. "You will come in here now," I said. "I'll take off." "No," Tim said, "you will not take off. I have further things to discuss with you. Is it your contention that I should not step down as bishop? When my book comes out about Jeff, I will have to step down. The church will not allow me to publish a controversial book of that sort. It is too radical for them. Put another way, they are too reactionary for it. It is ahead of its time, and they are behind the times. There is no difference between my stand on this issue and my stand on the Vietnam War. I buck the establishment on that, and I should, theoretically, be able to buck the establishment on the issue of life beyond the grave. But with the war I have supported from the youth of America, but in this matter I have support from no one," Kirsten said. "You have my support, but that doesn't matter to you. I mean public support, the support of those in power, those who control human minds, unfortunately." "My support means nothing to you," Kirsten repeated. "It means everything to me," Tim said. "I could not, I would not have dared to write the book without you. I would not even have believed without you. It is you who gives me my strength, my capacity to understand. And from Jeff, when we have contacted him, I will learn about Jesus Christ, one way or another. I will learn if the Zadokite documents do, in fact, indicate that Jesus spoke only second-hand of what he had been taught. Or possibly Jeff will tell me that Christ is with him, or he with Christ, in the other world, the upper realm, where we all go eventually, where he is now, reaching across to us as best he can, God bless him." I said, "You see, this business with Jeff, then, as a sort of opportunity to clear up your doubts one way or another about the meaning of the Zadokite." "I think I have made that clear," Tim interrupted peevishly. "That is why it is so crucial to talk to him." How strange, I thought, to use his son, make calculated use of his dead son, to determine an historical issue. But it is more than an historical issue. It is Tim Archer's entire corpus of faith, the summation for him of belief itself, belief or the falling away of belief. What is at stake here is belief versus nihilism. For Tim to lose Christ is for Tim to lose everything. And he has lost Christ. His statements to Bill that night may have been Tim's last defense of the fortress before that fortress fell. It may have fallen then, or perhaps before then. Tim argued from memory, as if from a page, a written speech spread out before him, as when in the celebration of the Last Supper he reads from the Book of Common Prayer. "The son, his son, my husband, subordinated to an intellectual matter. I could never myself view it that way. This amounts to a depersonalization of Jeff Archer. He is converted into an instrument, a device for learning." Why, he is converted into a talking book! Like all these books that Tim forever reaches for, especially in moments of crisis. Everything worth knowing can be found in a book. Conversely, if Jeff is important, he is important not as a person, but as a book. It is books for book's sake, then, not knowledge even, for the sake of knowledge. The book is the reality. For Tim to love and appreciate his son, he must, as impossible as this may seem, he must regard him as a kind of book. The universe to Tim Archer is one great set of reference books from which he picks and chooses as his restless mind veers on. Oh, he's seeking the new, always turning away from the old. It is the very opposite of that passage from Faust that he read. Tim has not found the moment where he says, "Stay." It is still fleeing from him, still in motion. And I am not much different, I realized. I, who graduated from the English department at UC Berkeley. Tim and I are of a kind. Has it not been the final canto of Dante's Commedia that struck off my identity when I first read it that day when I was in school? Canto 33 of Paradiso, for me the culmination where Dante says, I beheld leaves within the unfathomed blaze into one volume bound by love, the same that the universe holds scattered through its maze. Substance and accidents and their modes became as if fused together, all in such wise that what I speak of is one simple flame. The superb Lawrence Binyon translation, and then C.H. Grandjent comments on this passage. God is the book of the universe. To which another commentator, I forget which one, said, this is a Platonist notion. Platonist or otherwise, this is the sequences of words that framed me, that made me what I am. This is my source, this vision and report, this view of final things. I do not call myself a Christian, but I cannot forget this view, this wonder. I remember the night I read that final canto of Paradiso, read it, truly read it for the first time. I had that infected tooth and I hurt hideously, unbearably. So I sat up all night drinking bourbon, straight, and reading Dante. And at 9 a.m. the next day, I drove to the dentist without phoning, without an appointment, showed up with tears dripping down my face, demanding that Dr. Davidson do something for me, which he did. So that final canto is deeply impressed onto and into me. It is associated with terrible pain, and pain that went on for hours into the night. So there was no one to talk to. And out of that I came to fathom the ultimate things in my own way, not a formal or official way, but a way nonetheless. He who learns must suffer, and even in our sleep pain that cannot forget falls drop by drop upon the heart, and in our own despair, against our will, comes wisdom to us by the awful grace of God. Or however it goes. Aeschylus? I forget now. One of the three of them who wrote the tragedies. Which means that I can say, with all truthfulness, that for me, the moment of greatest understanding in which I knew spiritual reality at last came in connection with emergency root canal irrigation, 2 hours in the dentist chair, and 12 hours drinking bourbon, bad bourbon at that, and simply reading Dante without listening to the stereo or eating, there was no way I could eat, and suffering, and it was all worth it. I will never forget it. I am no different, then, from Timothy Archer. To me, too, books are real and alive. The voices of human beings issue forth from them and compel my assent, the way God compels our assent to world, as Tim said. When you have been in that much distress, you are not going to forget what you did and saw and thought and read that night. I did nothing, saw nothing, thought nothing. I read and I remember. I did not read Howard the Duck or the fabulous furry Freak Brothers or Snatch Comics that night. I read Dante's Commedia from Inferno through Purgatorio until at last I arrived in the three colored rings of light, and the time was 9 a.m. and I could get into my fucking car and shoot out into traffic and Dr. Davidson's office. Crying and cursing the whole way, with no breakfast, not even coffee, and stinking of sweat and bourbon. Sorry mess indeed, much gaped at by the dentist receptionist. So for me, in a certain unusual way, for certain unusual reasons, books and reality are fused. They join through one incident, one night of my life. My intellectual life and my practical life came together. Nothing is more real than a badly infected tooth, and having done so, they never completely came apart again. If I believed in God, I would say that he showed me something that night. He showed me the totality, pain, physical pain, drop by drop, and then, this being his dreadful grace, there came understanding. And what did I understand? That it is all real. The abscessed tooth and the root canal irrigation, and no less and no more.
three circles from its substance now appeared, of three colors and each an equal whole. That was Dante's vision of God as the Trinity. Most people, when they try to read the Commedia, get bogged down in Inferno and suppose his vision to be that of a chamber of horrors. People head up in shit, people head down in shit, and a lake of ice, suggesting Arabic influences, that is the Muslim hell. But this is only the beginning of the journey. It is how it starts. I read the Commedia through to the end that night, and then shot up the street for Dr. Davidson's office, and was never the same again. I never changed back into what I had previously been. So books are real to me, too. They link me not to just with other minds, but with the vision of other minds, what those minds understand and see. I see their worlds as well as I see my own. The pain and the crying and the sweating and stinking and cheap Jim Beam bourbon was my inferno, and it wasn't imaginary. What I read bore the label Paradiso, and Paradiso it was. This is the triumph of Dante's version, that all the realms are real, none less than the others, none more than the others, and they blend into each other by means of what Bill would call gradual increments, which is indeed the proper term. There is a harmony in this because, like automobiles of today in contrast to autos of the 30s, no sharp break exists. God save me from another night like that. But, goddammit, had I not lived out that night, drinking and crying and reading and hurting, I would never have been born, truly born. That was the time of my birth into the real world, and the real world for me is a mixture of pain and beauty. And this is the correct view of it, because these are the components that make up reality. And I had them all there that night, including a packet of pain pills to carry home with me from the dentist after my ordeal had ended. I arrived home, took a pill, drank some coffee, and went to bed. And yet, I feel that this was what Tim had not done. He had either not integrated the book and the pain, or if he had got it wrong. He had the tune, but not the words. More correctly, he had the words, but those words pertained not to world, but to other words, which is termed by philosophy books and articles on logic, a vicious regress. It is sometimes said in such books and articles that, again, a regress threatens, which means that the thinker has entered a loop and is in great danger. Usually he does not know it. A critical commentator with a mind that is keen and an eye that is keen comes along and points this out, or doesn't. For Tim Archer, I could not serve as that critical commentator. Who could? Dingling Bill had taken a good shot at it and had been sent back to his East Bay apartment to think better of it. Jeff has the answers to my questions, Tim said. Yes, I should have said, but Jeff does not exist, and very likely the questions themselves are irreal as well. That left only Tim, and he was busily preparing his book dealing with Jeff's return from the next world, the book that Tim knew would finish off his career in the Episcopal Church, and moreover deal him out of the game of influencing public opinion. That is a high price to pay. That is a very vicious regress. And indeed, it threatened. It was, in fact, at hand. The time for the trip to Santa Barbara to visit Dr. Rachel Garrett, the medium, had come. Santa Barbara, California, strikes me as one of the most touchingly beautiful places in the country. Although technically, which is to say geographically, it is a portion of Southern California, spiritually, it is not. Either that or else we in the North supremely misunderstand the Southland. A few years ago, anti-war students from the University of California at Santa Barbara burned down the Bank of America to everyone's secret delight. The town, then, is not cut off from time and world, not isolated, although its lovely garden suggests a tame persuasion rather than a violent one. The three of us flew from the San Francisco International Airport to the small airport at Santa Barbara. We had to go by two motorprop plane, that airport being too short of runway length to accommodate jets. Law requires that the city's adobe character, which is to say Spanish colonial style, be preserved. As a cab took us to the house where we would stay,
I noted the overwhelmingly Spanish design of everything, including arcade-type shopping centers. To myself, I said, "This is a place where I reasonably might live, if I ever depart the Bay Area." Tim's friends with whom we stayed made no impression on me. They consisted of retractable, genteel, well-to-do people who stayed out of our way. They had servants. Kirsten and Tim slept in one bedroom, and I had another, a rather small one, obviously made use of only when the other rooms had filled up. The next morning, Tim and Kirsten and I set forth by cab to visit Dr. Rachel Garrett, who would, no doubt, put us in touch with the dead, the next world, heal the sick, turn water into wine, and perform whatever other marvels were necessary. Both Tim and Kirsten seemed excited. I felt nothing in particular, perhaps only a dim consciousness of what we planned, what lay ahead, not even curiosity, only what a starfish living at the bottom of a tidal pond might feel. We found Dr. Garrett to be a rather lively, small, elderly Irish lady, wearing a red sweater over her blouse, even though the weather was warm, and low-heel shoes, and the sort of utility skirt suggesting that she performed all her own chores. "And who are you again?" she said, cupping her ear. She could not even figure out who stood before her on her porch. "Not an encouraging beginning," I said to myself. Presently the four of us sat in a darkened living room, drinking tea, and hearing from Dr. Garrett a narration delivered with enthusiasm of the heroism of the IRA, to which she told us proudly she contributed all the money she took in via her seances. However, she informed us seance was the wrong word. It suggests the occult. What Dr. Garrett did belonged within the realm of the perfectly natural. One could rightly call it a science. I saw in a corner of the living room, among the other archaic furniture, a Magnavox radio phonograph of the 40s, a large one, the kind with two identical 12-inch speakers. On each side of the Magnavox, stacks of 78 records, albums of Bing Crosby and Nat Cole, and all the other trash of that period could be discerned. I wondered if Dr. Garrett still listened to them. I wondered if, in her supernatural fashion, she had learned about long-playing records and the artists of today. Probably not. To me, Dr. Garrett said, "And you're their daughter?" "No," I said. "My daughter-in-law," Tim said.
"You have an Indian guide," Dr. Garrett said to me brightly.
"Really?" I murmured.
"He's standing just behind you to your left. He has very long hair. And behind you on your right side stands your great-grandfather on your father's side. They are always with you."
"I had a feeling that was the case," I said. Kirsten gave me one of her mixed looks. I said no more. I settled back against the couch with all its pillows, noted a fern growing in a huge clay pot near the doors leading to the garden. I noted assorted uninstructive pictures on the walls, including several famous loser pictures of the 20s.
"Is it about the sun?" Dr. Garrett said.
"Yes," Tim said. I felt as if I'd found my way into Giancarlo Menotti's opera The Medium, which Menotti describes in his album liner notes for Columbia Records as set in Mademoiselle Flora's weird and shabby parlor. "That is the trouble with education. I realize you have been everywhere before, seen everything," vicariously. "It has all already happened to you. We are Mr. and Mrs. Gobineau, visiting Mademoiselle Flora, a fraud and lunatic. Mr. and Mrs. Gobineau have been coming to Mademoiselle Flora's seances, or rather scientific sessions, every week for nearly 2 years, as I recall. What a drag. Worst of all, the money Tim will be paying her goes to kill British soldiers. This is a fundraiser for terrorists. Great."
"What is your son's name?" Dr. Garrett asked.
She sat in an ancient wicker chair, leaning back, her hands clasped together, her eyes slowly shutting. She had begun to breathe through her mouth, as the very ill do. Her skin resembled that of a chicken, with bits of hair here and there, little tufts like minor, scarcely watered plants. The whole room, and everything in it now, possessed a vegetable quality, totally lacking in vitality. I felt myself drained and being drained, my own energy taken away. Perhaps the light, or lack of light, gave me this impression. I did not find it pleasant. "Jeff," Tim said. He sat alert, his eyes fixed on Dr. Garrett. Kirsten had gotten a cigarette from her purse, but did not light it. She merely held it. She also scrutinized Dr. Garrett with evident expectation. "Jeff has passed across to the distant shore," Dr. Garrett said. "As the newspapers reported," I said to myself. I had expected a lengthy preamble from Dr. Garrett to set up the scene. I was wrong. She launched into it at once. "Jeff wants you to know that..." Dr. Garrett paused as if listening. "You should feel no guilt. Jeff has been trying to reach you for some time. He wanted to tell you that he forgives you. He has tried one means after another to attract your attention. He has stuck pins into your fingers. He has broken things. He has left notes to you." Dr. Garrett opened her eyes wide. "Jeff is highly agitated. He..." She broke off. "He took his own life."
"You are batting 1,000, I thought acridly.
"Yes, he did," Kirsten said, as if Dr. Garrett's statement was a revelation, or else confirmed in a startling way something up to now only suspected.
"And violently," Dr. Garrett said. "I get the impression that he used a gun."
"That's correct," Tim said.
"Jeff wants you to know that he is no longer in pain," Dr. Garrett said. "He was in a great deal of pain when he took his own life. He didn't want you to know. He suffered from great doubts about the worth of living."
"What does he say to me?" I said. Dr. Garrett opened her eyes long enough to fathom who had spoken.
"He was my husband," I said.
"Jeff says that he loves you and prays for you," Dr. Garrett said. "He wants you to be happy."
"That and 50 cents, I thought, will get you a cup of coffee."
"There is more," Dr. Garrett declared. "A great deal more. It's all coming in a rush. Oh, my. Jeff, what is it you're trying to tell us?"
She listened silently for a time, her face showing agitation.
"The man at the restaurant was a Soviet what?"
Again she opened her eyes wide.
"My goodness, a Soviet police agent."
"Jesus," I thought.
"But there's nothing to worry about,"
Dr. Garrett said then, showing relief. She leaned back.
"God will see that he is punished."
I glanced questioningly at Kirsten, trying to catch her eye. I wanted to know what, if anything, she had said to Dr. Garrett. Kirsten, however, sat staring fixedly at the old lady, apparently dumbfounded. So it would seem I had my answer.
"Jeff says," Dr. Garrett said, "that it is a matter of utmost joy to him that Kirsten and his father have each other. This is a great comfort to him. He wants you to know that. Who is Kirsten?"
"I am," Kirsten said.
"He says," the old lady continued, "that he loves you."
Kirsten said nothing, but she listened with more intensity than I had ever seen her displayed before.
"He felt it was wrong," Dr. Garrett said. "He says he's sorry, but he couldn't help it. He feels guilty about it. And he would like your forgiveness."
"He has it," Tim said.
"Jeff says that he can't forgive himself," Dr. Garrett said. "He also felt anger toward Kirsten for coming between him and his father. It made him feel cut off from his father. I get the impression that his father and Kirsten went on a long trip, a trip to England, and left him behind. He felt very badly about that."
Again the old lady paused.
"Angel is not to smoke any more drugs," Dr. Garrett said then. "She smokes too much." "What is it, Jeff? I can't pick this up clearly. Too many numbers?" "I don't know what that means."
I laughed in spite of myself.
"Does that make any sense to you?"
Dr. Garrett said to me. "In a way," I said, paying out as little line to her as possible.
"Jeff says he's glad about your job at the record store," Dr. Garrett said. "But," she laughed, "you're not being paid enough. He liked it better when you worked at the shop, kind of shop, a bottle shop."
"Law office and candle shop," I said.
"Strange," Dr. Garrett said, puzzled. "Law office and candle shop?"
"It was in Berkeley," I said. Dr. Garrett said,
"Jeff has something very important to say to Kirsten and his father."
Her voice now had become faint.
almost reduced to a rasping whisper, as if coming from a vast distance away, traveling over invisible wires strung between stars. Jeff has some dreadful news he wants to convey to the two of you. That is why he has been trying so badly to get through to you. This is why the pins and the burning and the breaking and the disordering and the smearing. He has a reason, a dreadful reason.
Silence then. Leaning toward Tim, I said, "This is a judgment call, but I want to leave." "No," Tim said. He shook his head. His face showed unhappiness.